And good morning once again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, here in somewhat chilly New Mexico, the land of enchantment. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. I'll be your host for the next 2 hours. We have a really intriguing show this morning, which prescinds almost synchronistically, hyperdimensionally resonantly, if I can say that, with the President's State of the Union address last night. And we're going to get into some specifics and some of the remarkable things that are on the horizon in a moment or two. But first, I want to continue on from what we did last night. Last night, we did a kind of an improvisational homage to David Bowie, David Bowie's tragic passing, which was a shock to an awful lot of people, even those that were very close to him, who learned belatedly that he had liver cancer and that he had lost his fight with that. It really is such a tragedy. Well, last night I had Mike Spent on talking about how Bowie's music had inspired him, both in his career and in his music and in his life and in his ideals. And, you know, Bowie had done a lot of that with a lot of people. So tonight I want to, just in passing reference, direct you to othersideofmidnight.com. Go to the upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to tonight's guest page. At the very top of that page tonight, link number one, is something called Far Above the Moon, another tribute to David Bowie, this one by Eric Francis Coppolino, who had been my guest a few days ago, and we discussed, among other things, hyperdimensional astrology. One of the many things we didn't get into last night with Bowie's amazing career is the incredibly deep and convoluted and multifaceted symbolism inherent in so much of his work. And I'm so pleased that Eric has actually, you know, filled in that gap that we were not able to get to last night because it was from a different perspective. So if you want to see another analysis of Bowie's impact on us, on our culture, on civilization, on the times in which we live, and the reflection of where we seem to be going, a la Bowie, I would recommend strongly that you click on that first link under Radio with Pictures tonight for a view of what Eric has said, because I think he's said some very, very important cogent things. Now, on the same page, showing the randomness of life these days and the fact that so many things are turning upside down, I have a link to the winning Powerball tickets. As you may have noticed, because even Robin went out a couple days ago and bought a ticket, the Powerball was up to $1.6 billion, having started sometime in, I think, late November. And there were no winners and no winners and no winners. And finally, last night, there were three winners in three states, one in California. I forget what the other two states are. But they will divide something like almost $2 billion. Can you imagine what we could do with a major fraction of almost $2 billion? The kind of private space program that we could mount, you know, aligning ourselves with Elon and people like Distler's Research and others. I mean, there's no limit to what we could do if we had that kind of money. So if anybody in those three states who's won tonight the $1.6 billion Powerball happens to be fans of The Other Side of Midnight, we would be most appreciative if you gave us a call. On a more serious note, my guest tonight is coming directly off some things that the President of the United States said last night. I know when I talk politics on this show, there are people that go, roll their eyes. And I've even had some email from some of our longtime fans who said, oh, you did it last night, I'm never going to listen again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, listen or don't listen. But, you know, the objective of this show is to discuss anything. I mean, anything. And from almost any perspective. So tomorrow night, as you know, it's later tonight. Tonight is the 14th. Yes, later tonight on, I believe, CNBC Business Channel, I believe, although I'm not sure. No, I'm sorry. It is Fox. I'm getting my parties confused. It's the NBC folks that are doing the Democrats a few days from now. But tomorrow night, later tonight, I think 9 Eastern, something like that. Check your listings for appropriate times. There will be another Republican debate, and of course the major personification of the debate is Donald Trump and all the things he's saying. So what we're going to do tomorrow night is something a little different. We're going to have a body language expert on, Scott Russo, or Russe. He spells his last name R-O-U-S-E. It's either Russe or Russe. Anyway, Scott is going to be here, and I'm going to have him analyze the body language, not the sound, not what they're saying, but how they're saying it. In terms of the candidates, I'm going to also have him take a look at the President's State of the Union and, you know, give us both some background on what he thinks he's seeing in Obama's body language, as well as the various close-ups that the TV networks have taken of people in the chamber, you know, Republicans, Democrats, the Joint Chiefs, the Supreme Court, individual guests, all that kind of thing. So tomorrow night is going to be a kind of an exploration into deep language beyond the idea of verbal spoken communication, because in the motif that this physics is driving consciousness now in directions it hasn't moved in a very long time, maybe in as long as, you know, 13,000, 26,000 years. And it will be intriguing to see what someone who is versed in bodily communication, which is a much more direct wired access to our unconscious intentions than the things that we say or the actions that we try to consciously impose on our persona. It'll be intriguing to see if Scott can actually penetrate the veil and give us some insights behind some of the things, certainly controversial things, that are going to be said later tonight. So that's tomorrow morning's show. And it came directly from the State of the Union idea that, you know, we're entering another political time frame here where we have the State of the Union, Democratic statement now because of the administration of the state of the country. And then tonight we're going to have the Republican candidates, obviously weigh in on the same thing. And given that both the president and the Republican surrogate who was chosen, Governor Nick Haley, to give the Republican response to the president's speech last night, and both of them agreed that the views espoused by one of the candidates, in fact, the leading candidate on the Republican side, are not in keeping, in tune, in sync, in resonance with the majority of the Republican establishment, that has set up a really intriguing scenario for, you know, hidden messaging. Hidden messaging in the unconscious mind, unconsciously controlling bodily presentations and actions and movements and eye movements and positions of heads and all that. So we're going to get into that, and that's going to be very interesting. Again, going back to the president's speech last night, he made certain very interesting claims of things he would like to accomplish in his last and final year of eight, which seems a little bit late to be initiating major projects. Like, I mean, that cancer initiative he announced last night, I find so intriguing and so mysterious and so laden with potential for being a signal to those on the inside that something major, something huge, which will have as one of its effects American technology being able to claim, American medical science, that it has actually cured cancer. Some people misunderstood that I was asking, you know, why was Vice President Biden put in charge of this effort? That's not the issue. It's obvious because of his son's, you know, premature death because of brain cancer that Joe Biden is the obvious guy. If you want to politically get something done in Washington, Joe Biden is the guy, you know, he's the go-to guy to go to get it done. And he has incredibly deep interest in this. In fact, I believe he asked the president to be assigned in this role. But the bigger question, the question that really is the question, everything else is irrelevant. Why now? Why this announcement? Why now, with only a year left, and give it to basically a lame duck vice president who's only going to be there a year? And the only thing that makes sense to me is if there is some kind of major announcement waiting in the wings that in fact, as some of my people who emailed me this afternoon, who are listeners of the show, said very perspicaciously, because they've already done it. It's about announcing it under a frame where the American people don't realize that there are lots and lots of discoveries that have been made, that have been stacked in that huge Indiana Jones warehouse that is, in fact, part of a whole huge conversation of suppressed science, suppressed technology, suppressed engineering, suppressed breakthroughs. And that leads me to my guest for this morning. Joel Garbin, whose name is spelled with a G and rhymes with carbon, which I find incredibly ironic considering we're going to be talking about, among other things, you know, carbon-based fuels. Joe Garbin serves as president of the nonprofit New Energy Movement, which educates about breakthrough energy technologies and their implications for human society and our imperiled planet. While also he serves as an advocate organization, as head of that advocate organization for inventors of those important technologies. Joel received a Bachelor of Science degree in Applied Science from Miami University of Oxford, Ohio. He has worked for more than 30 years as an international industrial science consultant and educator within the chemical, pulp, and paper industries, including water treatment. He is also an inventor and developer of several successful commercial technologies used within these industries. And he wrote a book a few years ago, which I think was reissued in 2011. I think the initial printing was in 2008, which, of course, was when Obama was first elected. The book is entitled Breakthrough Power. It was co-authored with Gene Manning, who is a luminary, almost legendary journalist luminary in the field of alternative and breakthrough energy coverage. Anyway, they've written this book called Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. And, of course, all of that is merely another way of talking about the hyperdimensional physics and torsion field that we do on this program. Joel, good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Good morning, Richard. Thank you for that very lovely introduction. I'm very happy to be on your program.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's an extraordinary time to have you because, as I said, last night the president made very aggressive pronouncements in the field of alternative energy. But for people that really aren't very up on this, on the details, just because you talk about alternative energy does not mean that you, in fact, are talking about breakthrough energy. Is that true? Okay, and we are back. That was most bizarre. Joel, have you ever experienced something like that when you were given a nice intro and then suddenly everything goes blank? I mean, I lost all the computers, like instantly, bingo, blue screen of death, all that nonsense.
Yes, so, it has happened before.
You'd almost think maybe it was something that we'd said.
Well, this is a very... Oh, uninteresting topic we're going to be talking about here, Richard. Why would anyone be, you know, interested in maybe diverting us?
My producer says it because you have a powerful aura. She says you blew the circuits. I don't think so. I don't think so, Em. Anyway, so last night the president talked about energy and alternative energy, but I want to make very clear to the audience that when the mainstream talks about alternatives, they're not really talking about alternatives. So, you know, take it from there. Start limbing out the real story we need to talk about tonight.
Okay. Well, let's talk about what we mean by breakthrough energy.
Good.
What the mainstream science and media and political scene means by renewable energy is wind and solar and biofuels. That's what the public hears about all the time. That's what the direction of all political lobbying has been. And that lobby now for those, what we call the conventional renewables of wind, solar, and biofuels, those lobbies are growing in power and actually starting to rival what we've seen as what the conventional energy resources, fossil fuel, nuclear, hydropower, have been for decades. That is not at all what my group, the New Energy Movement, is talking about. When we talk about breakthrough energy technologies, we're talking about new science, new technologies, things that go far beyond either the conventional fuels or the conventional renewables. We're talking about technologies that have much greater power density, meaning you could have a lot more power coming from a much smaller device. And these can tap into various sources of clean energy that are essentially inexhaustible.
And so hang on a second. So we're basically looking at a breakthrough, at a step function, at a stunning potential future, which is the equivalent of going from chemical fuels to nuclear, except it has none of the downsides of nuclear. There's no radiation. There's no excess environmental pollution. There's no health diminishing effects by standing too close to the generator. There's no stuff to be carried away and buried in landfills that will be deadly for 10, 20, 100,000 years. In other words, it's the same kind of energy revolution that we thought we were going to have with nuclear, but this time it comes with all the benefits and none of the downsides.
Exactly. And it would be unfair to say that there are no downsides to it. There still will be a cost attached to it.
Well, if you can look at cost as a downside. But given the cost, I mean, now we build power plants that last, what, 10, 20, 30 years maybe?
Generally, 20 years is the normal life cycle. Yeah.
Because of the flow-through rate and the fact that you would have distributed power if these systems were put in individual homes, and they basically don't have moving parts, they could last a lot longer, and they're so much less pricey than even conventional technologies like, you know, oil or gas furnaces.
Yeah, these would have a much lower cost for purchase of the device itself. But then there'd be a very, very low cost of maintenance, especially like you mentioned, those that have no moving parts, a solid state device, that is. Those really, there's nothing to wear out. There's no friction going on, no heat generated, no parts wearing away. So those would last a very long time. And that really would be the holy grail, having something that has no moving parts. It produces power output in the kilowatt range, and it could interface with the circuit breaker on the home, and it essentially provides all the clean power anyone would ever need at very, very low cost.
Okay,
that is the holy grail.
We're getting a little ahead of our story. Let's go back and look at this real alternative energy. You have looked at, with Gene, at probably, what, 100 different technologies, devices, inventors, machines over the years. Maybe I'm being overestimating or underestimating, but there's an awful lot out there.
I would say in my personal case, it's been dozens.
Okay.
For Gene, certainly that many. But with our colleagues who are several and who are positioned in various places around the world, we collectively have examined hundreds.
So what's the crucial essential difference between that technology, that science, and what we think we know in terms of both, you know, fossil fuels and nuclear?
Well, with the fossil fuels, we're dealing with normal chemical combustion, right? We have a hydrocarbon that's essentially being combusted with oxygen. You're making carbon dioxide and water. It's a very, very well understood chemical reaction. And what the desirable output from that is heat.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're looking for. And the vast majority of applications for energy in industrial situations and for much of the energy requirement at homes is simply heat to boil water. Whether it's to be able to take a hot shower, have a hot cup of coffee, or to actually make steam to drive a turbine at a centralized power plant and then use the mechanical power of that steam to turn the turbine and generate electricity. So heat output is a very, very key, desirable aspect of any type of energy technology, and that's what the hydrocarbon fuels and what conventional fissionable nuclear power deliver. They deliver a lot of thermal output.
Mm-hmm.
These new energy technologies, some of them will do that very, very nicely and very cleanly.
This is the so-called cold fusion types.
Cold fusion, also known as low-energy nuclear reactions, LENR, those do that very well.
They just basically release a lot of heat in one small place.
Yes, yes, very high power density.
Which is not chemical.
It is, well, that has been hotly debated.
He said very punnily, hotly debated, eh, y'all? Okay.
Hotly debated, Richard. So there is a tremendous amount of recent evidence that these cold fusion, LENR type of processes actually are nuclear processes. And that's because the what you could call the ash from many of these processes is helium.
Mm-hmm.
And helium can be readily measured, and it has been measured by very well-known laboratories, including our own national laboratories such as Los Alamos. Several different processes have been evaluated, background samples taken and compared to the process atmosphere, and has shown in some cases as much as 100 times the amount of helium as you would find in the background atmosphere. And that is what could be termed the nuclear ash, not in a negative way, because the helium is totally harmless, but what it is, it's showing that there actually are nuclear reactions that are happening in this process.
But, and this is interesting, are the reactions driving the heat, or are they another byproduct in addition to the heat of a process of energy that is not nuclear and is only giving us weird isotopes, because that's a side effect?
Well, some of the most careful measurements seem to show that there is an actual tiny loss of mass between the reactants and the products of the cold fusion reaction. And as we know from Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, a tiny conversion of mass into energy produces a huge relative amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of these measurements have very precisely determined that there's been a small loss in mass during the reaction. And so that again leads us to believe that there really are some nuclear effects going on here, but not to be scared of the word nuclear in this sense, because with the cold fusion or LENR type of processes, we're not generating the type of very high energy neutrons that become the source of dangerous radiation as those high energy neutrons bombard the local environment.
Yeah, there also appears to be a mysterious absence of the normal radioactive signatures like gamma rays or, you know, fissionable material that will basically, you know, divide or will cascade down and break down. If these processes are nuclear, Joel, they're certainly not the same nuclear physics that we're used to dealing with in terms of hot fusion.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the most intriguing things about this.
Okay,
and
so, it's also tell what, let's hold it there, because we're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Joel Garbon, or Garbone.
Garbon, like carbon.
Rhymes with carbon. He is a new energy expert, and because the president last night talked about new energies, alternative energies, as a major part of his last year in office, I thought we might talk about that tonight. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Why the purity of love, like a bride and a groom, will always stand united. Will not be divided. There's too much to lose. Blue are the waters surrounding the brave patriots from sea to shining sea.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. It's the temperature here this morning is just a little bit above 20, maybe 22, 23 degrees. It's chilly in the land of enchantment. So having a thermal source, which doesn't depend on fossil fuels or nuclear or anything that pollutes, would be amazing. Joel, why don't you continue the list of all these alternative technologies that apparently are grounded not in the familiar science that everybody learns about in school, but in a whole other kind of parallel science that, for some reason, most people are not even aware exists.
Well, we have aside from the cold fusion type of technologies, Richard, there's a number of others, including some plasma-based technologies that show a lot of promise to, again, provide a lot of thermal output. And also, interestingly, could use something very, very common that we're all very familiar with and we touch every day as the fuel, and that's water.
Mm-hmm.
So they're plasma-based technologies, and we're going to later hopefully get to see a couple of videos of one of these type where actually water can be used as the fuel.
Now, when you say plasma-based, how are you defining plasma?
Plasma, in this case, is a very high-energy, hot, ionized gas.
Okay.
That is around an electrode of some sorts. It might be in a spark gap, if you think like a normal spark plug. It might be the arc that's inside that gap, or it might actually be an electrode that has a type of glowing plasma around it. But it's a very high-energy state of matter that has unique properties and generally is capable of doing things that were formerly thought impossible, like transmute elements. And that's something that's being found very, very commonly now with plasma processes, is when the metals that are in the original either electrode or in the let's say a spark plug, in a few cases, when the metals are analyzed, they find that there are different metals there after the process has been running for some time than were there originally.
Wait. You mean just run like an electric spark between two metals, and then when you analyze the metals, I think there's a group up in New Hampshire called Quantum Rabbit that's been doing some of this stuff. And
yes.
When you analyze those metals, you find there are elements... other metals and maybe nonmetals in the metal of the electrodes that were not there when you started. In other words, there's been some kind of nuclear transmutation conversion, like the old philosopher's stone thing of lead into gold. Some process has converted that electricity into other actual elements in the metals of those electrodes.
Exactly. And that was thought to be only possible through very, very energetic nuclear fission or nuclear fusion type of processes, like what might happen in a nuclear bomb or inside a nuclear power plant or in these hot fusion experiments that have been going on for decades.
Or in a huge nuclear accelerator like at CERN.
Correct. But what we're finding is that in these relatively low energy processes in generating these plasmas...
That we could talk as tabletop experiments?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even in my kitchen. I've had this demonstrated a number of times in my kitchen.
Does your mother know you're using her kitchen for that?
Well, she did while she was amongst us. And she was quite excited, as was my father at that time, when they knew what their son had delved into. They were very excited about it. And, and I'm sure that they're rooting from the heavenly stands that all of this gets to have a social benefit.
One of the things we really need to point out is in total polarization to conventional major nuclear and chemical energy sources, this stuff can be done literally on a desktop or a tabletop and produce house-level energies that you could run your house from something the size of a microwave oven or maybe two microwave ovens?
Smaller. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I've seen prototypes and processes that would be, well, let's say the size of your cell phone.
What?
That could potentially put out 3 kilowatts of power.
That would run this house forever.
Yes.
And this studio. I mean, I'm looking at all these microelectronic stuff with Intel chips and all that. I mean, the actual power consumption to do a lot of what we do now is really very small. The major things that are left are things like what? Manufacturing, transportation of food, of materials, creation of structural materials like, steel and copper and all that. So those huge energy sinks, those huge factory needs for massive amounts of electricity, those could be supplied by these alternative breakthrough energy sources as well?
Yes, eventually that would be the case, because a lot of these technologies seem to be quite readily scalable, and that'll be important to be able to have the whole range of power outputs from the consumer level to power up their household devices and their home itself up to a conventional centralized power plant where you need to generate, you know, gigawatts of power. So you know, we're not saying that the grid needs to disappear immediately, because that's something that would be very, very hard, very slow to turn around. But certainly what we do want to have is distributed power where the generation is occurring right where it's needed. So,
one of the huge problems of the grid, you know, the grid needs to go away, because the grid is a huge impediment. It's an albatross around civilization. If we take these technologies, Joel, and we put power plants in every basement, in every apartment complex basement, in every mall, in every bank, in every government building, you don't need a grid. And then when you have hurricanes and you have snowstorms and you have all this incredible stuff that's going to happen with the weather because of climate change, you can just sit there like my family and I did in 1965, when the entire Northeast suffered a huge mega million power outage, 30, 40 million people in the dark, and we're sitting there in southern Massachusetts, just outside Springfield, with our lights and our stereo and our TV and all that. Of course, we didn't see anything on TV because there were no stations transmitting, but the TV worked. And the reason was we were connected to one of the early prototypical nuclear power plants in New England called Yankee Atomic. So you replace the Yankee Atomic with fission and the, you know, the environmentally bad stuff, with the idea that you had your own power plant environmentally friendly in your basement, and you can ride out anything and you never have to worry about another oil delivery, propane delivery, you know, gas bill, electric bill, because you're basically off the grid, but you're off the grid with enough energy that you can do almost anything, up to and including home 3D printing and material manufacturing of things you might not want to buy, you might want to make.
Pretty exciting.
So we're looking at a distributed society, which is the only way society, in terms of the future of civilization, is going to make it, because with more and more both natural and artificial impediments to cohesive social action, like now, you know, terrorists are threatening the grid and threatening the energy supplies of the country, we have got to diversify. So the next question, Joel, is this science there? And if the science is there to support these technologies, why can't I go and buy one of these things at Kmart tonight?
Well, there's been a number of reasons for that. I would say the biggest impediment really comes at the inventor level.
Oh, right, really?
Now. Yes, yes. It's not from some big suppression racket that's going on and squashing all these inventors who come up with a disruptive energy technology. And I don't want to dismiss the fact that suppression has played a hand, because it has, and we soberly acknowledge that, but we don't get paralyzed by the fact that those things go on, because that type of thing happens with very, very mundane technologies and business all the time. There's always vested interests in every aspect of business, and there is suppression that goes on just for things. I mean, a pencil manufacturer who comes up with a new type of a pencil that disrupts the pen manufacturer, well, the pen guy is going to try to leverage, you know, his advantage.
Or a little more relevant, maybe, look at what happened to Tucker and the Tucker automobile.
Yes.
Trying to go up against the big three. He was crushed because he was an innovator, he was outside, and they didn't want anybody outside in the club. And you're saying that's a large part of what's going on here?
No, I'm saying it's not.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
It's not the largest part. All I'm saying is we do acknowledge that suppression has happened, and I know inventors personally where they've been heavily touched by that and have been traumatized by that. But the larger issue, in my view, has been at the inventor level itself, where there's been an inability for the inventor to work together with a high-performance team of people who are competent, who are multidisciplined, and have been able to come together and marshal the technology along its development stages and to the point where actually can be in a manufacturing commercial prototype that can actually make it into the market. Usually it falls way short of that because of challenges that the inventor has in being able to work with other people. And so this is just purely a human issue. And
Wait a minute. You know, human beings are very long lived. We go back, you know, contemporary Homo sapiens, what, 30, 40,000 years, something like that, maybe 50,000. We've been inventing, and the idea that if you build a better mousetrap, you know, the world will beat a path to your door is kind of endemic to the whole American experience. Why are you saying in this alternative breakthrough energy area we have an inventor problem when you look at the field of inventors and technology in the rest of society and there's new stuff coming to the market all the time? Why are breakthrough energy inventors a special class where you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, you're saying they're their own worst enemy?
I think that there are certain reasons why that is the case. I think one is because when an inventor realizes that he has something that is potentially disruptive to the most lucrative industrial source of revenue, a multi-trillion-dollar annual energy economy, he knows that, holy cow, I have something that's extremely valuable. There can suddenly be these delusions that they're going to be this, you know, billionaire overnight. And so a lot of times they become very contracted in their behavior. They stop trusting people. They end up becoming so overly protective of what they're trying to do that they don't allow other people to help them. And I've seen that in time after time, and it ends up being very self-sabotaging to the inventor because there's a type of gold fever that goes on. And Richard, I don't know if you've ever dealt with people who've been in the gold mining industry. I have, personally. I know what that is like. I've seen what it does to people, and it's very distorting. And that happens in this field a lot. It's not just my observation. Many of my colleagues have seen the same thing, and would agree that this is a pretty endemic issue that's happened. Now, fortunately, what we've been able to do is we have been able to form relationships with a number of these inventors. We've been able to help them understand that there's a lot of people who want to help push this along, advance the technology into the public domain, because we genuinely care about what the hell's happening on our planet. It's not because people have this dollar signs in their eyes. It's because we know we've been given a mission to make this come about, and we're going to continue to do this, and we've been doing it for a long time. In our case, New Energy Movement, you know, we've been around since 2003. We have no paid staff. We have been doing this generally, you know, while we've had other jobs and had, you know, all kinds of other things that could distract us. But we have stayed with this, and we've been just continually moving this along and making progress. And it's been satisfying to see that. And now I can tell you, each of us feel like we are right on the cusp of some of these things breaking through, and that is exciting. So it doesn't take all the inventors having success. It only takes a few of them to have success.
But the question I have, Joel, is we don't have any of them who have success. Let me read you something here from your own preface. You say, as with the earlier personal computer revolution, inventors are making breakthroughs in home workshops and garages as well as in professionally run laboratories. Observers of these developments predict that this revolution will have more of an impact than PCs have had. These inventions could do more than transform our homes, vehicles, and factories. They could help clean up the water, air, and soil. And again, if you're comparing this to, you know, Steve Jobs, why don't we have a breakthrough energy Steve Jobs selling huge numbers of units to put in your basement and power your house apart from the grid like 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Why are we still waiting for Godot?
I think a big part of that, Richard, is it's by design, by policy.
Well, wait, you just said that the problem was the inventors, not policies. Now you're saying that it's corporate, it's government, it's policy?
There are several reasons, Richard. The inventor issues and the inability to form teams that can marshal this along, that I believe is key. I believe that's number one.
Okay.
I also believe that there are very well-designed policies that have held these at bay. For instance,
we're talking political and government policies.
Yes. Well, and this is very – anyone who's followed the cold fusion news for the last now 27 years
– isn't that amazing? –
wonders how come, despite the fact that our own national laboratories and our own U.S. military, especially the U.S. Navy, have all verified that cold fusion is real. But yet it has not gotten any support in Congress. It is held at bay inside the Department of Energy's own special agency that is supposedly for disruptive energy technology development. Mm-hmm. And that agency is called ARPA-E. It's modeled after DARPA. It's called ARPA-E. It stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy. ARPA-E.
Okay.
And what that has as its mission is to bring out disruptive energy technologies.
When was this government agency established?
I believe it was 2008.
So it's when Obama came in.
Yeah, just about.
Interesting.
Pretty close to that.
And we're 8 years later and we still have nothing on we can go to Kmart and buy.
Largely, that agency has been focused on improvements to wind and solar and biofuels and battery technology. They have totally ignored what we consider the really disruptive good stuff.
So we basically have two problems. We have the inventors, and I want to get back to the inventors in a second let me do that in a second. But you say we have another institutional problem, which is that government and corporate together have somehow made a decision. None of these radical new physics, new science, new fundamental ways of utilizing the universe technologies will be brought to market ever because they're too disruptive.
In 2007, Richard, I went to Washington, D.C. with a piece of draft legislation that I had crafted and shopped this around to a number of senators and congressmen up on the Hill, showing them that with a very minimal investment that would essentially amount to a cup of coffee per year per citizen, we could have $10 billion a year allocated to solely these disruptive energy technologies and move these things along very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And what I was told was that, look, you don't have a constituency. As in, you don't have a well-lubricated lobby who can help, put campaign funds together to get politicians elected. You're simply a voice out in the wilderness talking about this strange science. And we've got people from oil and gas and coal and nuclear power, hydropower, and now we've got the upstarts of wind and solar and biofuels. They're all coming here and they're writing checks.
So you basically say they told you you're not going to get anywhere unless you bribe us. That's what it is.
Well, it is.
Let's kind of use Donald Trump speak. He's talking about how Nick Haley, the governor of North Carolina, has come to him for money, and now she's turning and attacking him, and he's saying, isn't that terrible? Isn't that sad? Isn't that, it's like crocodile tears. The point is, you're saying that the 400 or 535 legislators, and we're going to generalize from the guys you talked to, and I presume they were all guys, that basically said, you don't have a pack. You can't benefit us or me, Mr. Congressman. Therefore, I'm not going to even take a look at this technology because it's so far down in terms of where I really am getting money for my campaigns. I don't need to worry about it. You don't have enough people that will make a difference in my professional career.
And I believe that's what's meant by you don't have a constituency. But also what was very clear is, the people who get into politics generally aren't people with much science aptitude. And they're dependent on technical advisors to give them some type of overview of anything that comes along technological. Now, if those technical advisors are coming from the mainstream academic community, which largely tends to be the case, if those academics are not familiar with the technology themselves, they're going to be very conservative in their recommendations because they don't want to cut off the gravy train. And generally, the technologies that we're talking about here are not well understood by the mainstream academic community. They have been castigated at all kinds of turns, and cold fusion is the best example of that. And so those the legislators end up getting technical advice that says steer clear from this. Don't do it. It's going to be political suicide. All right? And so that keeps incrementalism in.
But hang on. We waste an incredible amount of money in this government every year on stupid nonsense. You know, the sex lives of tsetse flies during eclipses on Thursdays from 1930 to 1945. I mean, we are funding studies in everything. Technologies, energy, military applications, far out blue sky stuff. This government has funded all kinds of stuff, a lot of it's secret. You're telling me that with demonstrable results from national laboratories, the Navy, the last time I looked, the Navy represented the nation in a very big way, the Naval Research Laboratory, et cetera.
Yep.
You're telling me that those results, when you take them into these senators and congressmen, they look at it and they say, we can't really do anything because you don't have a constituency that can outbid the oil and gas people.
Richard, I believe that the pizza budget at the Pentagon would be sufficient,
yes, exactly,
to be able to move these things out. But also look at this. In order to get elected president of the United States, it requires $1 billion for a $200,000 position? Now, come on, you're not beholden to somebody.
All you have to do is win this year's Powerball.
There you go.
This month's Powerball, yes.
Yeah, there you go, and you buy your own president.
And we have one guy actually trying to do that.
Yeah. Now, I was speaking to the other major factor here and what's been one of the barriers, and that has been the academic science resistance to this. You know, the way academic research goes is it is generally totally dependent on either government or corporate funding, and usually it's for research that is very incremental. It's rarely for anything that's truly disruptive. And researchers it is usually
for research which has practical immediate applications where your return on investment can be seen.
Exactly.
And if you're looking at the long-term major breakthroughs, the odds are they're not going to come to fruition next year, 5 years from now, maybe even 10 years from now. So there's always an incentive to fund short-term stuff that you know works versus long-term stuff that you may not know works. But again, as this government spends so much money on so much stuff, a lot of it just nuts, nonsense, trivial noise, how come there cannot be a political constituency put together, a PAC or whatever, that can direct some tiny percentage of those funds to produce developments and results that will stun people and will move it from the development to the commercialization stage?
Well, there can be. There can be, and that was what that piece of legislation, which I called the Energy Innovation Act of 2007, and you can find it on the newenergymovement.org website. What that does is it serves as a template for how any type of government level, whether it's at the municipal level all the way to the national level, and not just in the United States, but any country, they can use it, look at it, decide, hey, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And as I got... I speak at a number of conferences, and I do a lot of these type of interviews. The feedback was so overwhelmingly positive from the public about what that legislation was about, and the cost so minimal to the average citizen. They're like, this is a no-brainer. Of course, Congress will look on this favorably. But they didn't understand, like I did not understand, how the money trail works in Congress. I was totally naive, totally naive. But I got a real education, and it came with so much disgust. I think it's fair to say that I had never been so indignant in my life as I was on that particular trip to Washington, D.C. Fortunately, I had an elderly colleague of mine who had been through the political process, and he did a really good job calming me down and just saying, hey, Joel, you know, it's live to see another day, and this just shows we have to continue to go back to the grassroots. We have to just, you know, don't expect this to come through the government, because they're too focused on the current money trail. They're too focused on incrementalism. You know, we no longer have these Apollo type of programs or Manhattan Project type of programs.
I mean, you know what that's about. Except last night, what did the President of the United States announce?
Yes, he did.
An Apollo type, he called it a moonshot program for the last year of his presidency to solve the problem of cancer. And when I saw that, Joel, every alarm bell I had went ding, 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 because to me, if you're going to roll out breakthrough technologies, what's the first one that would catch people where they really live? Not energy, but something that affects each and every one of us who's ever been touched by a family member or a friend who has or has died of cancer, right?
Yeah, it'd be a healing technology, yeah.
So if, as part of a panoply of these technologies, all based on this secret physics, this secret science, this black ops research that is not allowed to come public, if that is part of what he was indicating last night may be revealed in the next year, between now and when he leaves office, which is literally within days of being a year from this morning, wouldn't that be a stunning revolution, and wouldn't that be a fitting way to make it to the next phase of wherever we have to go to save this planet?
Oh, it would be, but it's also a very nice soundbite. I mean, with no meat on it, and what's even meant by having the United States lead into this, the new generation of energy technologies, and be able to provide those to the world as a real leader in clean energy. I mean, what does that really mean? I mean, when the president talks about it, I don't know that he's talking our language, which means truly disruptive new type of energy technologies. He may be talking about, well, just, you know, continuing to pave over the deserts, you know, with solar farms, or putting up, you know, wind turbines, you know, on the oceans, and all this kind of thing. It does not necessarily mean that he's talking these very high power density type of technologies that we're focused on.
Okay.
I kind of heard what he said, and I, you know, and I listened.
Well,
I thought,
we need
well,
to see
that's
the,
interesting.
We need to see the follow-up, because, again, it's such an anomaly politically. What can you do politically in your last year that would have any effect unless somewhere back there there's knowledge of developments and technologies and science that is going to be revealed? Anyway, we'll be back in a moment. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Joel Garbon. We are talking about breakthrough energy. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how our society could be transformed if it is appropriately pursued and applied. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be right back. And we are back. So I kind of interrupted your litany of these technologies, because the thing that struck me over the years, Joel, is that in fact they are so amazingly prolific. There's so many different ways to tap into this energy that it's stunning to me that after decades of this discussion, we can't go out tonight to Target or Kmart and buy something.
Yes, Richard, it has been daunting. And I'll give you my personal feeling on this, and it's reflected by the thoughts of many of my colleagues, and I think backed up by some really good solid research. These technologies have been developed and deployed in black budget programs. These have been developed with taxpayer dollars and other sources of funding. And they've been used in various ways. I think it's I think there's a good amount of evidence that there are advanced propulsion systems that are human employed that are using these advanced energy technologies, but they're not being used for a social benefit. They're not being used to help remediate the environmental damage on the planet.
Like Fukushima. Why don't you stop there and talk about how, if these technologies were properly applied, Fukushima in 4 or 5 weeks could be totally cleaned up. Talk about that.
Okay, so you remember when I was mentioning about how some...
Go ahead.
How some of these unique plasmas have the property of transmuting metals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that has application in cleaning up nuclear waste, because if you can transmute radioactive isotopes into a safe non-radioactive isotope, there you have it. And there has been a number of experiments done with not just one, not just two, but a whole portfolio of these various technologies that show the ability to transmute radioactive waste. And there has been a significant amount of effort to get those included into the remediation strategies at various Department of Energy facilities, because it's the DOE that really is running these nuclear power plants and these sites like Hanford, where there's cleanup required. But generally, those attempts have not really amounted to much. But the technologies are very promising.
Well, I remember Gene Maloff, a name that obviously you recognize very well.
Yes.
Gene Maloff was part of an experiment with an old friend of mine who was the science editor at ABC News for Good Morning America. Mike, I forget his last name. He interviewed me a couple of times on Good Morning America on our work. And I was stunned one morning when I tuned in, and there he was interviewing a gentleman from Florida who had developed a cold fusion reactor that basically would be able to produce unlimited amounts of electricity from basically whatever plug it into.
Mm-hmm.
And that technology demonstrated live on Good Morning America the ability in like 20 minutes to remediate nuclear radiation from, I think, uranium, breakdown of uranium, which normally has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, and this professor was able to cut the radioactivity in his little reactor flask by a factor of 2 in 20 minutes.
Yes.
So the technology to remediate radiation, which has been the bane of the existence of the entire nuclear power industry, and now we're looking at potential terrorism and people attacking, nuclear waste products being moved from reactors to storage facilities if they're ever approved. In other words, this huge national and now social national security problem, again, there are answers waiting in the wings, and nobody ever seems to want to apply them.
I agree that has been the case. And I would say that, again, there's not just one technology that demonstrates that remediation potential of radioactive waste. There are several. And it's one of these things where, okay, where do we focus our efforts? Do we try to go down that route, or do we try to move these things forward as energy sources, which is something that is more appealing to the public at large, the grassroots, because it hits right in the wallet. Everyone knows that, my gosh, if I had an amazing low-cost energy technology available to me, that's going to save me money. And that's how the consumer votes. They vote with their dollar first. Remediation of nuclear waste is kind of one of those far away in the mind type of problems. It just doesn't have the sexy factor to it. Unless you're living somewhere, downstream of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation on the Columbia River, and I happen to be in Portland, Oregon, and downstream of that. So, maybe we're a little more sensitive to those, the potential for those applications.
Okay, so let's be a little more organized here. You've talked about cold fusion, which is basically a chemical reaction, or at least starts out as a chemical reaction, and we know the energy coming out is far in excess of any chemistry, and there are indications there are nuclear things going on because there are nuclear byproducts. What are some of the other machines and technologies that can basically tap into this plenum, this matrix, this ether of energy, this zero point, as some people call it, and can make and can make it available to everybody?
Well, some of the technologies are magnetic based. They might be on a rotary platform, what might be called a magnetic motor. And generally, those have some type of array of permanent magnets incorporated into the design. A good example of this would be if, and I imagine many in your listening audience have seen the Thrive movie that Foster and Kimberly Gamble had put out a few years ago. In the Thrive movie, there is a small video clip of a magnetic motor, and that magnetic motor is very real. And I can tell you in spades, that is the real thing. It produces an over-unity energy effect, meaning there's a lot more measurable output electricity than what's required to initiate the start of the motor.
Okay, so when you say a magnetic motor, kind of start at basics and describe what a magnetic motor is, because most motors are magnetic. All motors are basically magnetic. So what makes this not a motor but a generator or whatever it is?
Well, in this case, in a normal motor, there is some type of back electromagnetic force that essentially wants to balance out the force and cause a lockup. All right, where you can't continually spin in one direction and have a generating effect from that. The back EMF, it's called, wants to balance the forces and end up locking up the rotor. In the case of a magnetic motor that has essentially very powerful permanent magnets on it and incorporates a way to shield the back EMF, mm-hmm. once the rotor gets spinning, it can continue to spin. And there's a number of variations of this out there, many, many different designs. And there are quite a few inventors who really have something here. I've seen it demonstrated. It works. I've seen some that are very high output in the kilowatts range. Okay, so
did you ever come across an inventor named Troy Reed?
I have not met Troy personally, but I am familiar with Troy.
Okay, because I was able to get Gene Maloff to come down to Oklahoma, is where Troy lived, in Tulsa.
Right.
By the way, they have incredible restaurants in Tulsa. If you ever go to Tulsa, you got to eat the restaurants. The restaurants are amazing in Tulsa. Anyway, so we're visiting Troy, and he's built this magnetic motor. And he doesn't know how it works, but it works because he got it as a vision. Get this, he got it as a vision from ETs. This is exactly what he told us. Mm-hmm. And he's showing us this beautiful, incredibly wood-designed magnetic motor with the magnets, and they propel each other, and it rotates, and it solves the back EMF and all that. But it's kind of like something out of the 19th century that you'd see alongside a canal somewhere in New England. It's a Victorian piece of furniture that also is a, and I don't want to use the term free energy. I'm so glad you've moved away to breakthrough power and breakthrough energy, because this ain't free, but it's really, really, really cheap if we get it, and somebody apparently doesn't want us to get it.
Oh, sure. That's human nature here to protect your vested interests, and there's nothing real surprising about that, because it happens for all sorts of reasons and all areas of business. You know, that is the way we operate in a competitive market here, is people protect their vested interests through ways either legal and ethical, or illegal and highly unethical, and sometimes even violent. All right, but I'd like to think that we're starting to move away from that model of our social existence, and we have to embody that ourselves in how we conduct ourselves in this movement. And so having ethics and integrity are absolutely essential in all of this, and it's why we're able to generate trust among the inventor community, because they know that we sincerely want to help them with this. And so I don't want to digress too much on there. What I do want to mention is that there are some other type of technologies, as you asked. I mentioned magnetic platforms. There's one type that I said there, the magnetic motor. There are other types that have no moving parts. They are solid state magnetic devices, including some novel circuits. And on your board on your site that shows these different images, there is one picture on there of such a circuit. And it has power amplification.
Hang on. Let's go back to othersideofmidnight.com. Upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures. That takes you to Joel's page tonight, the guest page. And just scroll down. And which link are we looking at?
Okay. So if we scroll down to number 11.
Oh, number 11. Okay.
Number 11. So number 11 is a technology that was invented by an inventor named Jim Murray, and he calls it the Switched Energy Resonant Power Supply, or SERPS.
And he mentions the magic word, resonant.
Yeah, resonant, exactly. Resonance, principles of resonance are very key in these novel circuits that have power amplification and energy effect.
Okay.
And by over unit, we mean that the measurable power exceeds the measurable input. It doesn't mean that energy is being created. It simply means that it's being tapped from a source that's maybe not easily measurable by standard instrumentation, but that the output energy is easily measurable and has the appearance of exceeding the input.
Joel, how much of the resistance of bringing this these technologies to market, you know, so you and I can go to Kmart or Target or, you know, Costco or whatever and just buy them and use them and put them in the basement and take ourselves off the grid and do a whole bunch of other stuff. How much of the problem in getting it commercialized is political, you know, the disruptive aspect that, you know, big power companies, big government, big military does not want this distributed energy in the hands of all its citizens because that means there will be less control, less political control, okay? Or is the reason that it's so hard to get this to market because the physics and the science behind it are so different and alien to what we've been taught, what academia thinks, how the universe really works, that there's this huge hurdle of believability to where people basically who put forward these technologies are viewed as con artists and worse, because there's no accepted science to explain the anomalous and amazing results that they are getting?
Well, I think it's both of those and additional ones, as I mentioned earlier. But remember, the resistance from the academic science community isn't just because the science might be misunderstood or looked at as junk science. In many cases, it's just flat-out jealousy.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, heck yeah.
Are we talking Marconi and Tesla? Edison and Tesla.
If you are a highly degreed, quote unquote expert in your field, and then someone comes along who may not even have hardly any academic credential, but they have an innate genius for invention, and they come along with something that suddenly blows the doors off of any pre-existing research and have something truly disruptive and world-changing, well, guess what? That is pretty affrontive to the ego of the expert. And so we see that type of jealousy and turf protection all the time.
This happens in all areas of human endeavor. Why in this area, this crucial area which will free human civilization to become what it used to be? Why is this area the one where we can't get any inventions to market so we can buy them at Kmart? This is the quintessential question, because if we solve this bottleneck, then the future opens up and it's anything we want to make it.
Yeah, and that's why organizations such as New Energy Movement here in the U.S., Breakthrough Energy Movement in Europe, why we are moving forward to help make sure that that happens. And it's going to happen because citizens at large, just regular folks, are going to rally around this and help move this forward.
So
it's not likely to happen through governments.
If an inventor comes to you, if an inventor comes to you with, you know, he's in his mother's kitchen, he's made this incredible breakthrough, mm-hmm. and he comes to you and says, how do I get this to Kmart? How do you lead this individual, male or female, inventor, through the process of going from an idea to actually a working technology, to where you get investment monies, to where you get a national distribution, to where ordinary folks can go and buy it at Kmart?
Part of that comes from direct personal experience. I'm an inventor myself. I've gone through that process from the idea on the back of the napkin all the way through to highly successful commercial technology in the marketplace. So I've seen that whole process along the way. And others of my colleagues have seen that as well. So what we do is we get together with the inventor. If after vetting what they have, we believe that it really is a technology of merit, then we could start bringing other resources there that comprise a team, a high-performance team, because it's not just the inventor and the technology. You need engineers involved in that to take it from a proof-of-principle experiment to a pre-manufacturing prototype and then to actual manufacturing prototype. You need business people. You need legal people. You need marketing people. You need a real team.
You need a system.
You need to work like the way normal business works in just the conventional field of technology. And it doesn't have to be high technology. Again, even to get a new pencil out there, it requires those same steps.
So again, my question, Joel, why has this worked in every other area of invention? I mean, America is known for inventing and reinventing and reinventing and reinventing the future even before Madonna reinvented herself.
Yep.
How come we can't see the same process going on in the breakthrough energy area? There's no commercial technology I'm aware of tonight that I can direct my audience to go out and buy and demonstrate, not even an executive toy that demonstrates the energy is coming from somewhere and it runs and it runs and it runs and it runs and you don't have to change the batteries. Why can't we see it and buy it?
Well, I think there has been an array of resistive forces.
Huge. It's got to be huge.
Toward that happening. And Richard, here's where, well, I'll just say it. All right? If we are to believe that there are advanced propulsion technologies that make possible space travel to a degree that is far beyond conventional rocketry,
yep,
then it implies advanced energy technology.
Absolutely.
So if that technology is coming to our little blue-green sphere from other spheres and other places in the universe, that means that technology already exists. If it's been here and there's been interchange or exchange of technologies, it means that humanity in some form or fashion or faction already has access to that. For these technologies to come out through normal business channels could work very much against certain objectives, certain type of strategies and desires perhaps for control or dominance in its various forms, mm-hmm. that certain factions might want to continue to propagate. All right? So I do believe that there have been, call it high-level manipulation of this scene. And I would point to the fact that if you look at the advances in communication technology, telecommunications, in the last, let's say, 20 years, we all now have these amazing things called smartphones. If you look at computing technology, we all have these amazing laptop devices. All right. If you look at medical imaging technology, now you can have you be diagnosed at all different type of atomic levels and layering through MRIs and scanning devices and all these things. If you look at virtually any type of modern technology, you see an exponential advance in what is now available to the public. But if you look at military aerospace, what do we see? All right. we continue to have paraded in front of us vehicles that are flying through the air that are burning a fossil fuel, right? We had in 1991, Operation Desert Storm, it was the first time the public becomes aware of these stealth aircraft, all right?
Yep.
Now, if we're to think that, okay, inside the military aerospace development program, there's probably at least a 10-year pipeline of technology. So in 1991, after Desert Storm, it was about 1 year before they started to fly around stealth aircraft at fairs, at public fairs. Everyone's seeing this, all right? So that now is what, from 1991 to today, we're looking at what, 25 years approximately, all right? And then 10 years in the pipeline. So 35 years of technology in advance of stealth is what is inside our military. And if we're to assume, given all the resources that are available to our military and that whole community, all right, they have endless resources to have moved along that same exponential curve that we've seen in telecommunications and computing and medical imaging technology. Mm-hmm. That implies speed of light travel, okay?
Yep. Which would or beyond.
Or beyond. And I believe that that is the case.
Okay.
Breakthrough energy is the flip side of that. If you got advanced propulsion technology, you have advanced energy. If you have advanced energy, you got advanced propulsion capability. Those are very closely tied at the hip.
Yep. Okay, so let's go back to radio with pictures. You had us look at image number 11. What in the world is image number 12?
Image number 12 is a cartoon that I sketched and sometimes show it at conferences because it tells a little story about a very real technology that uses urine as fuel, human urine as fuel. In 1992, there was a Chilean inventor named Nelson Camus who demonstrated his technology called a urine battery at a technology expo in Pasadena, California. And he won best of show at that technology expo because he was showing that he was collecting from, you know, various people who were attending the trade show. He was just simply asking them, hey, I'm going to show you how this battery works and it will use your urine as the electrolyte and you're going to see it power up various devices. And he won the top prize hands down, and he was on every major news program that evening. I've seen all the video transcripts of it. You know, this was real. Well, what he did next was he had the technology, the urine battery, put into a General Motors EV1 electric vehicle. He had a team of drivers drive it from the Bay Area down to San Diego, using nothing but human urine as the fuel in that battery. And he was courted by a certain large oil firm that we all are familiar with the name.
And they made
a licensing deal with Nelson. It was a 10-year license in exchange for $5 million, and they got the technology for 10 years, and they promptly shelved it.
Wow.
And I've seen the patents for this. I have seen a demonstration of that type of technology. It's real.
And given that it's not breakthrough, it's just chemistry, but it's chemistry at such an interesting and simple level. Can you imagine, Joel, the impact in the third world, in villages?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
in India, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South America? Any place at night where you go to bed at night because there's no source of energy, but you know, maybe dung chips or wood, a little wood. Can you imagine if you could basically have the villagers pee into a battery, and the whole village could have light from the normal chemical human process of simply living in taking food?
Exactly. Exactly.
And you say these guys, this corporation, come on, mention the corporation.
No, I'm not going to do
that.
Why
not?
It's not necessary. The point is that this
Are you worried about being sued?
There's just no need to even go there, because it's why even take that risk, Richard? The point is that this is what's happened. I've had a long-standing relationship with this inventor. He is also one of these inventors, among several who I've met personally, who claim that they received the information for their technology by a type of download, sometimes in dreams, sometimes in their meditation, and they took the idea, they built it as communicated, and it worked the first time. And that there's been several inventors I've talked to where that's been the process for how they've received.
Well, that was the story of Troy Reed. He claimed he got it from some celestial communication.
Yep.
Anyway, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We've got one more half hour to go with Joel. We're going to get into phone calls if you want to call us and talk to Joel. A whole bunch of people were swirling around wanting to get in before. You can enter the conversation now. Our number is, our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. And our number is 505-796-8802. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning talking about breakthrough energy. When we come back, we're going to talk about the world as what it would look like if all the impediments to bringing this to market were removed and we could literally enter a new golden age. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Joel Garbin. Joel, you have a conference coming up I don't want to forget to mention. In fact, I think it's this weekend where a lot of this is going to be discussed for a whole bunch of people that need to know about it. Can you give us some more information and maybe a link or two?
Sure. The conference is called the Architects of the New Paradigm Conference. It's going to be in the Bay Area in San Rafael, in Marin County, there in the Bay Area. It's going to be on Saturday and Sunday of this coming weekend. And I'll be joined by Foster and Kimberly Gamble, who made the Thrive movie. Also Catherine Austin Fitz, Danny Sheehan, and Richard Dolan. And it's going to be really, really great, highly interactive with the audience. And the nice thing about this conference is it has a linear format, so everybody gets to hear everything, and that's going to be, I think, really a great value for everyone who comes. So whether you're in the Bay Area or beyond, please look into it. You can go to just Google Architects of the New Paradigm Conference, and you'll find it, and you can see how to get into it. So I really invite you to come. It's going to be really rocking.
Terrific. By the way, if you see our friend Mr. Dolan, can you give him a message from me?
Sure.
Tell him I'd like him to reconnect and reestablish the interview that we had scheduled a few weeks ago, which he unfortunately couldn't make because he had to travel to Portugal and there was no internet connection or something. I really want to talk to Richard about his whole breakaway civilization model. And so if you run into him, tell him that Hoagland would like to have him on the other side of midnight.
I'd be happy to do that, Richard.
Super. Okay, we've got somebody on the line here. Good morning. Where are you calling from?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to call to let you know that I believe that the topic that you're talking about is scaring someone, because it's sort of like there was a large bit of interference going on, and you can imagine that corporations and the government are probably trying to sabotage your show because of the... You know how that goes, Richard.
Well, yeah, and look, it is so silly. Apparently, for some period of time earlier in the program, we had two programs being broadcast simultaneously. I don't
know
how
that
happened.
Yeah, but you know what, Mr. Hoagland? That's not an accident. That's probably, you know, some agency, some corporation, someone that's fearful of the truth, and they're finding a way to interfere with your show.
Well, the question is, how did they get all my computers to die at the top of the show? I mean, that's never happened. I've never seen this is a brand-new computer. It went blue screen and went belly up and said, I'm dead. Anyway.
Well, And then the other thing I also want to say is that, you know, I know that you always do your very best to bring out, you know, topics to get the audience to think. And, you know, there's going to always be some, you know, some people that aren't, you know, as open-minded to those topics and stuff. And so I kind of just want to say that to the people. Oh, and before I forget, my room are your fans, and it's Midnight Express at IRCSorcery.net. We love your show. And to the people and to your detractors on DM Talk Radio, all I have to say is it's quite clever to be, you know, it's quite clever to post GIFs and snarky comments at night when you don't have to wake up in the morning to a job. So, you know how that goes.
Okay. Well, do you have anything you want to ask Joel?
No. I just wanted to just let you know of the interference and stuff, you know, just so that you could watch your back.
Yeah, thank you. And it lets everybody know that we're talking about something that's important. Before I get my next caller in here, Joel, why don't we start looking at the impact on this planet if we can overcome these political impediments? And I want to get to how we do that a little later on, but kind of look at the future of the world if, in fact, we could go out and buy this stuff beginning tomorrow at Costco or Kmart or Twitter, whatever.
The potential is outstanding. If we look at the whole issue that seems to be front page almost every day about climate change and the concern about the burning of fossil fuels.
And I want to get to how we do that a little later.
Please turn down your radio. Go ahead, Joel.
Yeah. Hey.
George, don't. Just mute your mic, please. Joel, continue, please.
We know that climate change is a huge issue right now, and there's a lot of concern about the human footprint from having burned so much fossil fuel and continuing to have a huge appetite for the combustion of fuels. This would give us an opportunity to go into a whole new era of clean energy and have the potential to mitigate the climate impacts of the greenhouse gases. So that would be one obvious thing here, all right?
Okay.
Some of the other things here. Imagine being able to have, due to very inexpensive, clean energy that can be deployed in a distributed fashion, you would be able to grow food anywhere on the planet, Arctic, desert, under the oceans, anywhere. You would be able to have buildings that are skyscraper type, that you could essentially be a farm inside a building that would have a very small footprint but could feed hundreds or thousands of people so easily. We wouldn't have to use so much land in order to do our agriculture.
So lots of cities actually could take old abandoned skyscrapers or buildings and turn them into vertical farms and use these energy sources in the basement to basically, you know, recycle water and produce light, you know, 24-hour light for growing things on an accelerated schedule, et cetera, without things like chemicals and fertilizers. And you could use hydroponics and you can recycle that way. Energy, free, cheap, not free, but very cheap energy, which does not pollute, being the key.
Yes. Next thing, water. You would be able to have clean water anywhere on the planet. You would have the ability to actually extract it from the air itself. I mean, you know what a dehumidifier is.
Yep.
A dehumidifier takes water right out of the air. It's clean water. But a dehumidifier uses a lot of electrical power to do that condensation process.
Currently, well, from the grid.
If the energy was very inexpensive and essentially unlimited, you could really use even that conventional type of technology with one of these new energy sources to be able to have water anywhere on the planet. And remember, there are billions of people on our planet where the thought of having a clean glass of water is unimaginable.
How many children, Joel, on the planet die each night because they drink polluted water?
It's thousands.
It's unconscionable. And the idea that one power source that could give you, I mean, literally, if we take the most basic breakthrough energy technologies that produce just heat, right?
Yeah.
And we use that heat to boil water, to sterilize water. We stop the deaths of hundreds of thousands of kids every year because they drink polluted water. That one breakthrough would transform. Now, the other problem you're going to have is, how do you feed and house and clothe all these people that you save from dying? In other words, everything has consequences. Think of the biggest consequences of ultimate distributed non-environmentally damaging energy sources.
It ends up uplifting the whole village, the whole town, the whole city, because having a new power source like this with very, very clean, inexpensive distributed energy now would spawn a whole new wave of inventorship. There'll be all kinds of derivative businesses that come out of this that we can't even imagine right now. They'd be retrofitting the whole vehicle fleet on the planet with clean power sources that don't have to burn any kind of dirty fuel. That just that industry alone, that retrofit industry for vehicles, is an enormous opportunity. Think about what would happen to our roadways, which right now tend to be very polluted wherever there's like a major highway, interstate, major roadway. Imagine that if we had clean vehicle fleets and that soil was remediated along all those medians, we could grow fruit trees. We could grow all kinds of produce right along the roadside that could be free for the picking. A citizen might have adopt a tree, all right? They adopt an apple tree or something along the roadway. They take care of the tree and they make it free for anyone who wants to stop and pick the fruit. I mean, imagine what type of community that would produce, having people just sharing out of the goodness of their heart and the stewardship interest for a planet that they love. This just uplifts all of our society. The potential is just, it's just enormous, and it's really unimaginable. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful vision of what we could have happen. It's part of what we're going to be doing at this conference this weekend, is soliciting from people their ideas on what could this look like. Envision it together. Our minds are very powerful. Our collective thoughts are very, very powerful, and we're going to be sharing ideas. And as ideas are shared, they're strengthened. And this is going to come about. So I'm not worried about suppression and all these other things. All right, those things, their day is coming to an end. We are going to have this happen because of millions of people, their love for their families, for their neighbors, their communities, and for this planet. This is going to happen.
Have you noticed in pursuing the energy technologies, which are based on this physics, on this unknown main science that's unknown outside of the black ops and the intelligence communities on both sides of the old Iron Curtain, have you noticed there's a tremendous affinity and a crossover between the energy generating technologies and healing technologies?
Yes, there's a very strong correlation. In fact, one of my colleagues, Dr. Thomas Vallone, who has his own organization called Integrity Research Institute, he and his wife, Jackie, they host an annual conference called the Conference on Future Energy. And that conference is divided between energy breakthroughs and the corollary electromagnetic healing technologies that are an offshoot from this. Mm-hmm. There's a very, very close parallel to this. Okay. So you could imagine if we're driving a vehicle that's powered by one of these clean electromagnetic type of technology, you could be bathed potentially in a very harmonious energy that provides a healing benefit to our own bodies, and it eliminates fatigue, eliminates inflammation, starts to allow and stimulate the body's natural healing response.
Let's go back to our subspace radio and bring Torch into the conversation. Torch, what did you want to ask?
Yeah, hi. I was curious. Are you familiar with the Keshe Foundation and the unit that he put out back in November?
You're talking about the major Iran breakthrough, okay? Yeah. Joel, why don't you talk about the Keshe Foundation and Iran? Because I have another addition to the Iran story I want to get into tonight. And, Torch, you asked the perfect question to give me the opening to ask that question. So, Joel, pick up on what Keshe is doing.
Okay, so Keshe...
And you might want to give a little background, who he is, where he started, what they're claiming, etc.
Okay, so Keshe is a scientist who lives in, I believe, in Belgium, and he's Iranian by descent, and you know, he's made a lot of very bold claims about energy technology and water technology and anti-gravity type of propulsion and things that are very, very bold claims.
Unless you understand the physics is there to do it. So, but politically, yes. The idea that an Iranian, given the loaded term Iranian right now, is coming forth with a claim to have these breakthrough technologies all in a package in some form, that's what triggered my interest. So where is Keshe now, and what has happened to the testing of his technology?
Well, Keshe has had quite a bit of airplay and supposedly has been providing blueprints for how to build some of the rudimentary energy devices. I have yet to have a colleague who pays close attention to that and who has said that they have found something very real and compelling. I have not met the man personally, so I have no strong opinion on it myself and on what he's about, because I have not met him. I haven't seen the technology myself. So to me, the jury's out. But I haven't yet heard from colleagues who are much closer to where he is, including my colleagues at the Breakthrough Energy Movement who are based in Holland and who have made personal invitations to Keshe to come and demonstrate to them
right.
this technology. And they would help promote and propagate this like crazy. If he were to accept that invitation, because we are the allies of this whole field.
So you're telling me that this guy has a potential breakthrough. He's making a lot of claims. He's appearing on media, and he's been issued an invitation to cooperate with your foundation and with the folks there in Holland who began the Breakthrough Energy European institution, and he's not responding. He's not cooperating.
That's correct. And so that has been very disappointing.
Well, this goes back to your claim that the real problem in all this is not the government, not the CIA, not the boogeyman under the bed, it's the inventors.
Yes, exactly. I don't want to castigate the man because he may have something very real, and I hope he does. I hope he does, but it's been very challenging to find some fire under the smoke so far. But let's hope that he does.
Well, let me give you a very weird scenario, and I have no idea whether this connects or not, but when I saw the problems that were going on behind the State of the Union last night, because I don't know whether you're aware, but when the president was giving his address, there was this kind of high drama between the U.S. military and Iran going on in the Persian Gulf. You know, 10 U.S. sailors had apparently, on two boats, 38-foot boats, had drifted because they were under some kind of mechanical or navigational stress. They had drifted into Iranian waters and been picked up by the Republican Guard and taken to a specific island and kept prisoner. And then they were released through diplomatic relations a few hours later. But the mystery is, what would cause two state-of-the-art naval vessels with five sailors apiece sitting in the middle of the Persian Gulf to lose navigational control, GPS, that would allow them to drift into Iranian waters?
Well, it could be some type of electromagnetic jamming. We have that. Our military has that. The Russians have that. The Chinese have that. That could be... You know, that could explain that. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's an advanced energy technology involved or whatever, but and there could be all kinds of mundane reasons as well. But yeah, I can't really comment further on that without knowing more about.
I'm just wondering if there's a story behind the story here, because again, if what Keshe is claiming he can do, it's based on physics and engineering that is not just electromagnetic. It works with the underlying field. That field, if you manipulate that field, the torsion field, you can shut down electronics. You can basically kill them. You can make them die. Have you ever heard incidents, witnesses who reported seeing, you know, UFOs close up and their car engines just died?
Yes.
It's that kind of an effect. The effect is the torsion field effect on electromagnetic processes. So when I suddenly saw the president is making a statement about releasing advanced information as part of a super, you know, concentrated development program in the next year on cancer, at the same time that he's negotiating through his Secretary of State to release American sailors who have somehow had two boats simultaneously impacted by something that caused them to drift into Iranian waters. And I just had the feeling that maybe we're looking at technologies that are not part of the open source discussion.
Possibly, Richard.
Okay, well, let's not get hung up on that. Torch, did you have anything else?
Nope, that's it. Just was curious if you guys knew anything about that unit and how it performed. I know it's plasma-based, but no, until somebody builds one and actually tests it out.
Well, the Russians had developed plasma-based so-called breakthrough energy devices that are, you know, I mean, torsion field physics and plasma physics go hand in hand. If you have plasmas, you have torsion. If you have torsion interacting on gases, you have the creation of plasma. So I would not be surprised if, in fact, that is the basis of Kesh's technology. The question, I guess, before us is Kesh, Joel, going to actually really make a commercial impact in this field?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, Richard. I mean, the inventors who our group is much more interested in are those who have demonstrable prototypes.
Okay.
That are producing real power. No smoke and mirrors. There's no big kind of like a political platform behind it and all the drama. They're real. They give you access. They want to work with you. It's just something that's much more practical to deal with from the whole platform. Okay. And that means from the inventor to the technology and all the way through.
Okay.
So those are the people who we're really interested in.
Terrific.
Well, supposedly he gave out the blueprints for constructing it back in November.
This is Kesh.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks, Torch. We're going to go to our next call, but thank you for the input. Thanks.
Thank you.
Night-night. Okay, on our next call, there you are, and we'll welcome you to the program. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Yeah, hey, Richard, this is Dana from California. How you doing
Dana,
tonight?
Dana, the creator of Club 19.5.
Hey, guys. Hey, Rich, you brought up a very interesting point. And by the way, Joel, you're about the most cognizant, coherent person I've ever seen or heard speak on this subject other than Richard, so I appreciate this tonight. But, Rich, you brought up a real interesting point about unintended consequences. Just to cut to the point real quick here, what do you think would happen to all the metro areas if suddenly if transportation was available on vehicles where there was no cost involved?
When we say no cost, we mean a minimal. Nothing in 3D can be no cost, but you can drop the cost by factors of 10 or 100 or 1,000, and then it becomes basic. When was the last time you paid for a pencil?
Yeah, well, how do we address the infrastructure problem first? I mean, we have all these different people with different cars traveling at different speeds. I live up by an area where people go skiing. On the weekends, you cannot get out. It's not navigable. So what do we do for infrastructure?
Yeah, if you're asking me here, that part I think is a separate issue here, because if we're still largely a commuter society going to centralized places of business, you're going from the suburbs into an urban core, you know, that's going to remain an issue as far as the infrastructure and the amazing waste of time and productivity. So looking at new type of vehicle platforms, I think is going to make a lot of sense. Imagine if we had all of the roads or a small fraction of the roads in our country that were used for arable land, growing good organic produce or whatever. It would just be an amazing new resource that we could have to do productive things with. To have millions of people every day just sitting in traffic is one of the most unproductive scenarios we could possibly have. I think energy can have some bearing on that, because you can if energy is very cheap, you can suddenly do all kinds of amazing new things, from construction to remediation to freeing up people so that their creative genius can be tapped into. In fact, that may be the single greatest benefit of a new era for clean energy, is to free up people to think and to share ideas and to launch us into just a whole beautiful new world of bounty and health and beauty. I mean, that's the vision that I see for this, and I think it's going to happen.
They're awesome. They're fantastic. Really, honestly, there are some beautiful ideas. I just cringe on what would happen on weekends or holidays when you could go wherever you want.
Well, unfortunately, Dana, we're out of time, and we can't solve it tonight, but we'll pick it up the next time we have Joel back, okay?
Take care, guys.
Thanks much. Yeah,
thank you.
Joel, thanks so much for being a part of the program tonight. You've given us a kind of a window on what we might have. The thing that we want to leave people with is what? That this is real science, real engineering, real technology, and we need people to bring it across the finish line?
Yes, this is real, this is powerful, and this is going to happen. Everybody is a stakeholder. Everybody is a stakeholder in the outcome of this whole scenario here. So we can choose to let others decide.
Okay, Joel, I'm sorry. I think our connection's breaking up. And we're at the end of the program, so we'll pick this up on our next episode with Joel, whenever that is. Remember, tomorrow morning, we're going to be doing something different, body language of the debate. And until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.